This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 9th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the Supreme Court hears a case on redistricting in Texas. It brings up how far the federal government should go to protect voting rights.
I would not give automatic citizenship for getting out of college. I would allow young people who happen to be in the U.S. outside the law to join the military.
As Republican presidential candidates court voters in New Hampshire, we'll look at their positions on immigration. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Bahrain's highest court overturned the death sentences of two pro-democracy activists today and sent the cases back to the appellate court. The high court ordered the same for another five people who'd been sentenced to life in prison. All were convicted of killing two police officers last spring. The decision came after a new witness emerged who says the charges were fabricated. In another retrial, dozens of medical professionals convicted of crimes against the state were back in civil court today. Their retrial came after independent investigators appointed by the king criticized the secret military court that initially convicted them. And over the weekend, Bahraini immigration officials turned Physicians for Human Rights leader Richard Salem away at the airport, saying NGO personnel needs special permission to enter the country. Salem had planned to observe the medic's trial. Nigerian police killed at least three people today during nationwide protests that brought commercial activities to a standstill. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The smoke from bonfires blew across many Nigerian cities today as citizens expressed their anger at the government. The protesters were joined by professionals like lawyers, doctors, authors, leading musicians, and other celebrities. The January 1st removal of petroleum subsidies made the price of gasoline go up more than 100%, doubling from about the equivalent of $1.70 per gallon to more than $3.50. The fuel price jump has caused hardship for everyday Nigerians, most of whom live on less than $2 a day. The workers' union called the indefinite strike and protests that took hold in cities across the country, shuttering businesses and emptying the streets of all but protesters. The government says it must end the subsidies because it needs the money to develop infrastructures. But many Nigerians say official corruption is so rife that even if the government saves money from the subsidy removal, it is likely to be looted. Even though Nigeria is Africa's leading oil exporter, it imports gasoline because its refineries are not functional. The labor unions say the protests and strikes will continue until the government restores the subsidy. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
The FDA says that powerful painkillers packaged at a Lincoln, Nebraska pharmaceutical company may have made their way into the containers of other drugs. Opiates like Percodan and morphine sulfate were bottled by Novartis Consumer Health. The advisory was issued on the same day Novartis issued a voluntary recall of over-the-counter medications like Nodose and Excedrin, packaged at the same plant, warning that pills of one drug may have found their way into bottles of another. FDA spokesperson Shelley Burgess says the likelihood that the painkillers made their way into the over-the-counter medications is very low. However, the FDA has advised consumers and pharmacists to take precautionary measures.
We are asking pharmacists to perform a visual inspection when dispensing the potential affected endo-opioid medications according to instructions that we provided on our website. And those instructions simply ask pharmacists to visually inspect and verify the identity of all tablets dispensed.
More information on both the over-the-counter recall and the prescription drug advisory can be found at FDA.gov. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar announced a 20-year ban on new uranium or hard rock mines on more than 1 million acres of land adjacent to the Grand Canyon. Mines currently in operation and existing claims will not be affected by the ban. The move also does not affect all natural resource development. Mineral and geothermal leasing will still be allowed. There's been another massacre in Mexico, presumably related to fighting between criminal organizations. Shannon Young has more.
13 bodies were dumped early this morning at a gas station in Zitácuaro in the Pacific Coast state of Michoacán. Local media reports indicate the victims were all shot in the head and that three were minors. The state body responsible for murder investigations had not released a written press statement with further details as of deadline. The act of dumping multiple corpses in public spaces has increased in recent months. In at least two notable cases, the piles of bodies were accompanied by brazen messages from rival groups considered to be at a tactical disadvantage in the area where the bodies were left. The last double-digit body dump was on Christmas morning near Tampico, Tamaulipas, not far from the state line with Veracruz. The massacre also comes 1 week after the murder of 31 inmates at a Tamaulipas prison. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Arizona Representative Gabrielle Giffords marked the one-year anniversary of the Tucson shooting in which six people died and a dozen people were injured, including the congresswoman. At a candlelight vigil Sunday evening, she led the crowd in the Pledge of Allegiance.
One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Representative Giffords has served three terms in Congress. She's not yet decided if she will run for a fourth. The 23-year-old man facing 49 charges in the shooting, Jared Loeffner, remains forcibly medicated in a Missouri prison. A report on his mental fitness for trial is due January 25th. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Republican presidential candidates are racing through New Hampshire to drum up votes for Tuesday's primary. Though Latinos make up less than 3% of the northeastern state's population, some candidates are reaching out to this demographic, which is growing in size and political influence. Republicans are also looking to capture support from Latino voters disappointed in President Obama's record on immigration. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports from Manchester, New Hampshire.
In a small Mexican restaurant in downtown Manchester, reporters and activists crowded in with members of the Latino community to hear former House Speaker Newt Gingrich explain how he would tackle the issue of immigration.
If we're not going to disintegrate as a country, we're going to actually have to say to people, glad you're here, we want you to learn to be an American, and as Americans, we're going to work together as one team to create more jobs, to create greater opportunity, and to create more freedom for everybody.
Though Gingrich's plan involves further militarizing the U.S.-Mexico border and making English the official language of the U.S., the fact that he proposes a path to legalization for some of the more than 11 million undocumented people in the U.S. makes him more appealing to Latino voters than his competitors. Rick Perry recently appointed Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio as his Arizona campaign chair, even though the Justice Department is currently investigating Arpaio for racial profiling and abuse. Buddy Romer says undocumented people must return to their country of origin before applying for a visa. Rick Santorum opposes providing health care and education services to the undocumented, and New Hampshire frontrunner Mitt Romney promised to veto the DREAM Act, a bill that would provide a path to citizenship to undocumented youth who completed college or military service. When questioned about his position on the DREAM Act, Gingrich explained,
"There are parts of it I like. I would not give automatic citizenship for getting out of college. I would allow young people who happen to be in the U.S. outside the law to join the military, and I would allow them to earn citizenship by the act of serving in the military."
But what about the engineers and the doctors and the lawyers or the kids who don't want to join the military?
That's Jose Antonio Vargas, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who publicly came out as undocumented last year. Vargas, who came to New Hampshire to cover the election for The Guardian and other outlets, says most political candidates oversimplify and misrepresent the current immigration reality, especially when they talk about securing the U.S.-Mexico border.
I wish that whenever Romney or Gingrich says that people would just automatically stand up and says, this is the lowest amount of people crossing the borders since the Nixon era. The border has been secured. That reactionary secure the border first is a talking point that no longer fits the conversation. And I didn't cross any border. My border was the Pacific Ocean. So I come from the Philippines. Not every undocumented person comes from Mexico.
Though nearly 70% of Latino voters favored President Obama in the last election, he may not receive such strong support this time around. A 2011 survey by the Pew Hispanic Center found that Latinos overwhelmingly disapprove of President Obama's record on immigration, mainly because deportations have risen to record levels since he took office. Even those who once supported the president, such as Colombian American and Manchester resident Mauricio Galvis, are now searching for a better option.
I'm a Democrat, but concerning what's been happening right now, what's going on with the situation, I'm considering becoming independent.
The New Hampshire organization Latinos Unidos organized the Gingrich Town Hall event. Many of the attendees, says longtime member Diego Cataño, haven't yet committed to a candidate or even a political party.
You ask the Latinos for who, and they're going to tell you we don't know yet. So we're waiting. Like I said, as an independent, I'm looking at everybody. See, it is a very important election, I think, this time.
Comparing the 2008 elections to the current cycle, journalist Jose Antonio Vargas says it isn't only Latinos who are breaking their traditional party affiliations and weighing the policies of all candidates before committing their support.
I think you're seeing a generation that is much less concerned with party identification than issues, and I think that's a good thing.
In New Hampshire, whose state motto is Live Free or Die, more voters are registered undeclared than Republican or Democrat. Polls show Mitt Romney with a wide lead leading into Tuesday's primary, but his rivals are holding event after event to court the voters who haven't yet made up their minds. Alice Olsen, FSRN, Manchester.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case that could have implications for voting rights in the country. In Perry versus Perez, the focus is on a controversial redistricting map in Texas that could affect thousands of voters in an area with a rising Latino demographic. Several congressional seats are at stake, and some analysts say the high court's ruling could affect a key part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that was designed to protect access to the vote for communities that have been historically denied that right. For more, we spoke earlier today with Keisha Gaskins. She's senior counsel at the Democracy Program at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice. Keisha Gaskins, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
First, let's begin with the new congressional map passed by Texas lawmakers last summer. Why was it done, and how would it change the district?
Well, the districts are changing due to just every 10 years at a minimum. Districts have to be redrawn to comport with for the requirements of one person, one vote, and this is part of that redistricting process. In addition, Texas added 4 congressional seats due to a very large increase in population, 2/3 of which is due almost entirely to the Hispanic population in that state.
And with that rising population, according to the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, there are more than 1.3 million Latinos in that area, representing 33% of Dallas and Tarrant County residents. Yet there are currently no majority Latino congressional districts in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. That's according to the Legal Defense Fund. What are the maps being considered now, and how would they change the districts?
The maps that are being considered will change the district. So we obviously the Texas districts then comport with the one person, one vote following the population changes. The difference between the maps arguably is a different sort of a political control. Certainly the Republican map, the maps drawn by the Republican legislature and signed into law by Governor Perry certainly benefited the Republicans more. And the maps drawn by the San Antonio District Court had more of a benefit for Democrats. However, in both cases, each party, each side, of course, defends the maps as constitutional.
Some observers of this case have pointed to the possibility that the Supreme Court will take a look at Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 does include Texas. What does Section 5 require under the law, and how does it apply to this case heard by the Supreme Court today?
Certainly. Under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, certain jurisdictions, including the state of Texas, have demonstrated such a history of discrimination in voting in other areas that the federal government and the Voting Rights Act requires any change to election law, and that includes redistricting, to be pre-cleared by the federal government to ensure that whatever change is not discriminatory to minority groups who are protected under the Voting Rights Act. So for Texas had to submit those maps under Section 5 for pre-clearance. It did so, by its right to the circuit, the D.C. Circuit Court. But due to some procedural matters, namely Texas choosing not to go straight to trial but trying to have the case dismissed under summary judgment, the case extended, forcing the San Antonio court then to order a hearing to create interim maps in time for the Texas election. And so the San Antonio maps that are produced by the court, the state of Texas, found them unacceptable, and arguing they did not show sufficient deference to the legislative maps, and that appealed to the Supreme Court for a stay of the implementation of those maps.
Talk a little more about this Section 5 of the preclearance and how that has affected redistricting in the past, what kind of safeguard that puts into place for this kind of process, perhaps in other locations or other states, and why that's an important part of this Voting Rights Act.
Sure. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act offers as a stopgap measure for jurisdictions that have actually demonstrated a history of discrimination. The Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act operates to ensure that under the evaluation by the federal government that minority populations are not unfairly discriminated against by these changes in election law. So it does slow down the process, certainly for those states, but most importantly, it ensures that minority populations are adequately represented under law and have the opportunity to elect candidates of their choice.
Now, the Supreme Court has taken up similar issues in the past. In a 2009 case, Justice Clarence Thomas, in a dissent to a case, called Section 5 unconstitutional. What was his argument for that, and is there an indication of how other justices view this topic?
Certainly, past cases certainly give some indication on how the justices feel about the constitutionality of Section 5. This case in particular, however, it is very unlikely that the court will reach the issue of constitutionality.
It's more likely that they will focus specifically on the redistricting maps in this one area rather than make a broad ruling, I guess, on the constitution.
Absolutely. They will most likely focus on the procedural matter here, which is where you've got an interim map proposed by a court and no finding of unconstitutionality or illegality under either the Constitution, Section 2, or Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Does that court have an obligation to defer to the legislatively enacted plan or the legislatively passed plan, rather than implementing a plan that shows no deference to that plan?
That's Keisha Gaskins, senior counsel at the Democracy Program at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice. In New York, Occupy Wall Street is continuing to shift its focus away from occupying parks and squares to other actions such as occupying homes. It's part of an effort to fight evictions and the lack of housing, especially in communities of color. In Brooklyn, occupation of a vacant home has entered its second month. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr visited the residents and brings us the story.
27-year-old father of two, Alfredo Carschizio, has been in and out of homeless shelters for nearly 10 years.
When I was going through the shelter with my kids and their mother, and we decided we didn't want to go through that no more, and that's why I wound up couch hopping, because I didn't want to go through that experience anymore.
But after getting the support of community and church groups and Occupy Wall Street's Occupy Our Homes campaign, Carschizio spearheaded an effort to find a new home for his family.
So as you can see, as you step inside, this is our front area right here where we have some people sleep at, whoever's going to be spending the night.
Carschizio moved into a vacant home in Brooklyn's East New York neighborhood, which has experienced high rates of unemployment, foreclosures, and abandoned homes. Teams of Occupy Wall Street protesters have joined Carschizio in shifts to defend the occupation around the clock. They're also working alongside him to fix up the house and make it hospitable for his wife and children.
So I felt it was my duty and obligation to stand up as a young man of color from these communities to lead by example, to show that there's nothing ashamed with admitting that the system is wrong and is not allowing you to progress and be productive and own your own property and become a productive citizen in society.
In December, activists carried out a nationwide day of action to reclaim foreclosed homes from bailed-out banks and move homeless families into them. Although Carschio is risking arrest, he hopes he'll gain a permanent home for his wife and children, who are 5 and 9 years old. He's in negotiations with Bank of America and the former owner to gain legal ownership of the property.
I came to this point where I jumped on this opportunity, and I wanted to make it a national movement to help all the families that are homeless and dealing with this situation that I had to deal with.
Some neighborhood residents are expressing support for Carschio and the efforts to fight back against corporate lending practices. Longtime Brooklyn resident Doyle Coleman lives three doors down.
It's something that me and the family welcomes, and also members of the community, because anytime you have vacant property that's an eyesore with no upkeep, nobody to maintain it, nobody to care about it, it brings the value of other people's property down.
Occupier Homes is a shift of focus for activists in New York. Organizer Elliot Tarver says they're now organizing actions around the needs of local communities.
It's moved past just being symbolic, which is really what sleeping in Zuccotti Park was, to taking things like homes and doing actions that create lasting change and that affect people rather than just spread a message, which is also important.
Tarver says Occupy Wall Street should not only build relationships with local communities, but put community members and organizations at the forefront of the movement.
But I think the concept of bringing together these different constituencies around an issue like housing or like student debt or whatever is a really important way to work and to kind of bridge gaps between the people who've been doing this organizing for years and years and years and this new movement, which now has a ton of momentum behind it and a lot of resources. And so I think tightening up those working relationships is going to be a really important thing on the agenda in the next couple months.
A recent study by the Center for Responsible Lending examining home loans received between 2004 and 2008 found 1 in 4 borrowers in low-income areas have been foreclosed on or risk foreclosure. More than 3.5 million people could still lose their homes to foreclosure, on top of the 2.7 million who already have. To reverse this trend, activists, including the group Take Back the Land, are vowing to expand eviction defenses and occupations across the country. Similar actions are underway in Atlanta, Chicago, and Seattle. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
In Canada, unsolved cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women are growing. Recently, the United Nations announced it will initiate an inquiry procedure. Indigenous leaders have long called on authorities to look into the ongoing problem. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story from Montreal.
According to the Native Women's Association of Canada, there are more than 600 unsolved cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women across the country since the 1980s. This has been a pressing issue for Indigenous communities in Canada, as the families of these women continue to demand accountability from police forces and different levels of government. However, some solace came for Aboriginal communities in December when the Native Women's Association and the Feminist Alliance for International Action announced that the UN had initiated an international inquiry procedure into the matter. If the inquiry does go through, a team of 23 people could come to Canada to investigate the crimes. The UN carried out a similar inquiry in Mexico 5 years ago. Jeanette Corbière-Lavelle is the president of the Native Women's Association of Canada.
We asked them to come to Canada, much like they did in Mexico, so that they can open up the investigation, bring all the key players together, the government, the policing forces, our families and our women, and us as an Aboriginal women's organization. We would, you know, be at the forefront to work with them and come up with some key recommendations that could be initiated right away. And maybe one of the first ones would be a national inquiry on missing and murdered Aboriginal women.
According to Lavelle, last summer, the Native Women's Association of Canada called for the federal government to conduct a national inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women, but they got no reply. Instead, the Stephen Harper government cut all funding to Sisters in Spirit, a program of the association which conducted research and funded action to solve the issue of missing and murdered women. In its place, the Harper government devoted $10 million towards a new program called Evidence to Action, which helps to fund a national police support center and a missing persons tip website. Many families aren't happy with the government's new approach. Bridget Tolley's mother, Gladys, was killed in 2001 when a Quebec police cruiser struck her on their Algonquin reserve of Kitigan-Zibi.
You know, when they made that $10 million announcement for the missing and murdered, most of that money is going to the police, you know. And if you hear the stories from families, the police aren't doing anything. And a lot of these families have problems with the police and stuff like that. So I don't think this is a really good idea. And they say, oh, some of the money is for the missing and murdered. Well, it's not. It's for the police.
Tolley is also frustrated because she feels that money could be used towards other more effective solutions. Many family members also draw attention to police inaction, or even worse, complicity in these deaths. For example, last November, former Royal Canadian Mounted Police Corporal Catherine Galliford revealed that her own force and Vancouver police officers would often watch porn on the job and leave work early to get drunk while they were supposed to be working on a missing women task force. Galliford and 25 other current and former female Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers are now filing a class action lawsuit against the force, charging it with sexual harassment and assault in the workplace. FSRN asked Mohawk activist and former president of Quebec Native Women, Ellen Gabriel, what she hoped would come out of the UN inquiry.
Well, hopefully action. There is a 23-person panel of the UN that's going to be making an inquiry into Canada's lack of action and the situation, you know, investigating what the families have been through. And so hopefully some protocols that the police will be able to use, some more awareness among children and youth and the roles of men and women in our communities, and for people to really understand that the root causes of violence, especially amongst in Aboriginal people's communities and in society at large, stems from colonialism.
The Canadian government did establish a committee to investigate the issue last year, and it issued a report to Parliament in December. However, Gabriel, along with Amnesty International, slammed this report, calling it watered down and criticizing it for ignoring and deleting any references to witness testimonials and their recommendations. While Native women wait for the inquiry to begin, they are hoping that the UN committee will be able to work with all levels of government and police forces in order to develop a more concrete course of action. Despite the federal government's lack of action, the president of the Native Women's Association of Canada expects it will cooperate with the international investigation. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapshi and Janine Etter. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.